Three, two, one. Hit it.
16.
16.
15.
Oh,
we've got a roll off.
I'm going to pass to Chaz because I have a card.
All right.
All right, Chaz, take
it. I am the host. Mike is not the host for the first time. All right. Welcome to the Escort Mission. I almost forgot the name of our podcast.
See, it's not easy, is it?
It is not easy, no. I am Chaz. Mike, you are Mike. Say Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Josh, you are Josh. Say
I am Josh.
Mike.
Mike.
Okay. welcome to the Escort Mission. We are going to discuss a number of things. We're going to have general chatter as we usually do. We are going to talk about games journalism and then your ever favorites, a Not My Thing and a Best Game Ever are all going to go through. But let's chatter generally. General chatter, worst Battlefield general ever. He was not good. He just wanted to discuss things. He never directed his troops.
General chatter.
You're up, Mike. Chatter.
Okay.
Chatter away.
Okay. Just so you know, for people who can't see me, I saluted How I Met Your Mother in joke. All right. So lately, this week, I have not been playing a lot of games. I've been working on music for other things. Just so you know, if you haven't read my About Me on our website, I'm kind of the music guy here. I did the music for the podcast, and I do music for lots of things. So, but of the games... Oh, speaking of which, I just want to start off by talking about one of the recent music things I did. Which is not so recent anymore. It's actually a couple months, but there's this indie free Windows indie game called Impulse. I was approached a few months ago by a guy making a game. He wanted music. I've never been approached before by a game maker to do this, so I was incredibly stoked. Made some music for it, kind of moody space puzzle related ambient noise music, and the game came out. I don't know, a month ago or so. Soundtrack's been out for about a month and a half. You can get all my stuff at nebulae.com.
How do they spell that?
I'll put it in the show notes or whatever.
Okay.
Is the game final? It was released?
Yeah, the game's been final for a while now.
I thought you told me it was beta.
No, it's gold, I would say.
Well, I should go play it now.
Yeah, you should go play it. I actually played it a little bit. It's fun. It's kind of Super Meat Boy meets Lunar Lander-ish kind
of
game.
It. That's a good X meets Y description.
Yeah, yeah. Because I kind of ripped that off of his own description. So that was really cool to do. I can't wait to do more of that kind of stuff. So, but as far as gaming, still been playing Fez. Fez is sweet. I know Charles has gotten ahead of
Fez
me.
Is so what did you beat sweet? Holy shit.
I just haven't had a chance because I've been doing other things. So when I finally get around to playing it, I'm like dead tired. And you got to be on to pay attention to that game. Because it's deep.
You can get lost.
You can get lost, and it's deep, and there are levels to that game. You could play it as a very simplistic 2D platformer, or you could get embroiled in the world that is Fez.
I don't know how deep it is.
I think it's pretty damn deep.
Because he's seen things that we haven't seen. Charles, I'm pointing at Charles.
I've seen things.
Oh, have you beat it?
How many cubes?
Oh, you beat it. Okay, well, maybe you've seen things.
I got 100% or so.
100%.
You know, that's what it says when you beat it.
Yeah, if you look at, Charles, if you look at leaderboards, everybody on your friends list will tell you a percentage of how much they've done.
You're at 180%.
Okay.
180? God, man, you're way further than me.
I have 52 cubes.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. I have 33.
Okay, yeah. So have you solved any of the major cryptographic stuff?
I got one artifact.
Okay, I am at two artifacts, and I solved one of the key cryptographic puzzle challenges. Which enabled me to get that big jump of cubes.
Are those good?
I thought it was fucking rad when I did it. I thought it was I was super stoked and I had that rush of discovery.
Okay, the cool part wasn't the end. The cool part is after the end, the more stuff you
get. The new game plus is the game, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, really?
The first game that you play is that, as Mike said, is a 2D platform with an interesting... A 2D platformer with an interesting mechanic of this rotation.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I was going to resume on a new game plus. I was like, well, that was good. I feel experienced...
You should do that.
Except for the really hard, crazy part. But the really hard, crazy part is the good part. So I should
go back. The really hard, crazy part is the true puzzle of the game, which is figuring out... is scrutinizing every landscape and figuring stuff out from there. It's not any different. It's not like there's...
It doesn't turn into an RTS or something.
It doesn't
like
turn into a different game.
Are you sure?
There is.
I don't know, actually.
You're not at 200% yet.
I don't know, no.
If I say anything else about what happens in New Game Plus, I will start spoiling for Mike who hasn't gotten there yet.
Yeah, don't say stuff. No. So yeah, Fez. Fez is great.
Fez is really good.
It's quite good.
That's pretty much
The first ending was the good part, in my opinion.
The first ending was awesome. God damn you, Mike.
Yeah, don't say shit. All right,
guys. Let's talk about it.
Okay, so I just want to get in a couple iPhone games that are really sweet that you guys, some of you know them, some of you may not. Hero Academy, you guys know about this game. It's a, like a sort of a defend the crystals or defeat the enemy, like kind of strategy game, put your pieces on a board, chess-like kind of game. Asynchronous multiplayer, it's really sweet. I kind of burned out on it a little bit.
It's tactics, right?
It's tactics, yeah, sorry. It's a tactical, move your pieces around. You only get 5 moves around, and you have to, try to strategize to take out the other team or their crystals. I kind of got burned out on it because I was stupidly playing, a dozen games at once. Just because as soon as I was done with my round, I wanted to keep playing, and I'm like, damn it, I've already been through the 5 friends that are playing it. Well, I'm going to start adding random people that I don't know just so I get more games. But that means I burned down on it in about a month, and I actually deleted it for a while because I'm just I can't play this game. It's too much. But it's great. I also introduced Charles.
Wait, so you're back on it?
I'm back on it.
Reinstalled it? Okay.
Blockus, which is a board game that is also now an iOS game that you can play against a computer or against multiplayer. And I told Charles about it, and he thinks it's cool.
Yeah, it's good.
I don't know if it's on Android as well.
I'll check.
But it's cool. And a game that is not multiplayer at all, but is sort of my, I've got a soft spot for the crossword genre of games where, or word-based games, but not necessarily like Words with Friends or such. This game called, I think it's 7 Little Words. And it's basically just like a guessing game, crossword thing where every round is 7 words and there's a simple clue. And they give you little chunks of words, like 2 or 3-letter combinations, and you have to use those chunks to guess the answer to each one of them, and then you beat around, and there's like 50 rounds per...
Is it you're answering a question, and the answer is 7 words
long? No, it's like a crossword. It's a crossword puzzle. And instead of having to guess all the letters, they give you little chunks of letters that you piece together the answer. So that's a nice little zen 5-minute, beat around kind of game. Because, I do like crossword puzzles occasionally. And it's not that hard. It's not like the New York Times crossword where you have to be ridiculously good at crossword puzzles to figure it out. And there's like 20 or 30 packs of them, like 99 cents a piece. So it's pretty inexpensive. I'm not sure whether I want to be the one to bring up Diablo 3 because the open beta is out and I did play for an hour last night. Do we want to save this?
Did you play it, Charles?
I did not get a chance to play it.
Did you play it, Josh?
But I've seen a bunch of it being played. When it first came out,
are you gonna play it?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm
this
not gonna.
Weekend?
Yeah,
there's nothing to spoil.
You can't really spoil it. I've watched somebody play through the entire demo.
What's your
online.
Opinion, Mike?
Well, I'll preface it by saying I played a lot of Diablo when it came out, and I played somewhat less Diablo 2, but some.
We are in the same boat.
And I was not super excited about Diablo 3, mainly because I already played a bunch of Torchlight, and I kind of got my Dungeon quest loot fix. It's a Blizzard game. It is kind of the peak of the genre. They make genres, and I think for the most part, for my hour of gameplay is not really enough to judge it completely, but it's well done. It's moody, it's atmospheric. You can tell that this is the company that makes World of Warcraft because it feels almost like you're getting into it initially, like with the UI and the title screen and the fact that you sign in with an account now rather than just starting a game. Like everything is essentially like multiplayer, even if you're only playing alone.
Blizzard is just taking everything to Battle.net.
Yeah, it is a Battle.net property now rather than like a game in a box. Yeah.
So are you sold? Are you going to buy it?
I'm not going to buy it now, but I was never planning on buying it.
But you played Torchlight.
And I did buy Torchlight, and like I said, I think that ruined me a little bit for Diablo 3.
Because if Blizzard, as you say, makes the best in every genre or whatever field they enter, they epitomize that genre. That is Torchlight better? I mean, you played Torchlight.
Well,
it's $40 cheaper, isn't it?
Basically,
that's one thing.
That's key. I think you make the false assumption that just because it's the best, that, you know, that it automatically gets my vote.
That is my assumption. Why would it not?
Right. Because objectively best is not necessarily like my best in terms of like, oh,
we're talking about you and your opinion. Right. So and how is it not your best?
Well, I'm just, well, because A, yes, it is more expensive, and B, mainly because it came out after I got my dungeon loot fix. Like, I see it as like a genre of game, not Diablo 3. Whereas other people probably see it the other way around. They're like, oh, I can't wait for Diablo 3. Whereas I'm like, I can't wait for a good dungeon hack crawl. Loot yeah. game crawl. And that game came out, and it's called Torchlight. And I played it a lot, and it was fun. And even if Diablo 3 is objectively better, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to buy it or that I'm going to play it a lot or something. So, but that's me.
What
I'm
about
weird.
Torchlight 2? Are you excited about that? If that, which it, I mean, that is coming out. Are you,
right.
Would you probably and, buy and, that instead of Diablo
3? Instead of Diablo 3? Hmm. That's probably a better question.
Like, I don't Torchlight know. 2 is going to come out in whatever, you know, 6 months or something like that.
That's a good point.
At that point.
I don't know.
Especially if Diablo has fallen in price by that point.
I don't know. I don't think I'm as much of a fan of the genre, so I probably won't buy either.
No. So I feel like what I feel like what you're getting at is that even though Blizzard has created, you know, well executed dungeon crawler, it doesn't bring anything original to the table. It is basically exactly this 10-year old game
mm-hmm.
That doesn't do anything new. That's definitely my opinion. The skill tree system is different than 10 years ago, but it takes bits and pieces from all kinds of other games.
Mm-hmm.
And it does it very well. That's very well executed. The different characters are very cool. And the way that you switch their abilities and they kind of make the characters play very differently is very cool. For example, the Witch Doctor, the number one ability or the left click, the primary spam click mm-hmm. ability, is either shoot a poison arrow or toss
like
a jar of spiders.
Okay.
And tossing jars of spiders is really a dramatically different theoretical activity, right? But in reality, you're still spam clicking. It's just a different spam click.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I think it's very well executed, but I don't think it does enough new, and I don't think Blizzard in general does enough new.
In a way, it's sort of like what a sequel used to be. Like, when the NES was the only console, and it was out for like 12 years or something, and you got multiple sequels, and it's not like you could get more graphical fidelity out of an 8-bit console, right? The games were 8-bit games, right? And I don't know. There are some NES games that look better than others, but in effect, there's not like a big leap graphically that's going to happen. A sequel was just like more of the same. Right? It was like, Mega Man 2 is Mega Man, right?
And Mega Man 3 is Mega Man.
Totally, yeah, yeah. Mega Man 10 was self-consciously Mega Man because they came all the way back and they're doing it on a new console that they could have made look better, right? They could have made it look different. I'm saying on the NES, you really couldn't make it look dramatically different.
Well, so, and I think, yeah, that's sort of
sort of a throwback sequel.
Yeah, well, and I think that's like a false comparison because you can't say that the NES of 1985 when it came out versus the NES in the mid-90s when it died is the same as the PC that you owned in 85 versus the PC you owned in 97. They're very different capabilities, and so thus you can have a Diablo 3 on the same system, i.e. PC. But PC encompasses a wide range of technology.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, what I'm saying is basically it's a sequel the way they used to be on consoles when or similar. Obviously, the game looks a lot better than Diablo 1, right?
Yes.
So they are doing something new in that respect, right? Yeah. It looks better. The skill tree mechanic is cool. The way I think so. Basically, you have a set of skill points, but you can reallocate them at any time amongst skills that you learn.
There's right? no points.
Or so
you
what?
Just change ability. You slot ability.
You just slot. Okay, yeah, yeah. So they have even distilled it further than that. Yeah. Which is cool. I mean, that's
a little bit like...
So isn't that like Guild Wars, essentially?
It's a little bit like Guild Wars, except in Guild Wars, you unlock, you know, these 100 or a couple hundred abilities, and then you just have to choose your deck of 8, basically, like a collectible card game. And in this one, you unlock abilities that are specific to a slot.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, after a few levels, you have 2 or 3 options for your main attack. You have 2 or 3 different options for your secondary attack. and you have two or three different options for your supplemental ability, number mm-hmm. one. Right, but you can't just pick and choose from all of them.
Right. Yeah.
So each one is balanced within its class of ability, not balanced with every other ability in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, like Guild Wars was, every ability was kind of balanced with every ability in the game, except for this one exceptional type of ability, which is called an elite. Mm-hmm. And then all the elites were balanced.
Gotcha.
So I think I'm done. We've been gone off on a long tangent for me, but...
Yeah. Diablo 3 is cool. All right, Josh, general...
It's not that cool. It's kind of cool.
It's cool. I mean, it's if you've never played Diablo, this is the one to play, right?
Oh, that's
it's
absolutely
the same
true.
Game, uh-huh. and it's, you know, as a genre, it's worth playing. So
I think it's one of those properties.
A bit. It's worth trying, right? It's fun. You sit down, and you have a good time for an hour and a half playing that game.
Yeah,
like, you're not like, oh, this sucks. You know, you're having a fun time.
Yeah, they didn't make a bad game. They just didn't make a game that I'm like, you know, like. Orgasming over.
It's not a game that you can get mastery on.
I can't believe I said
right?
that on this. God damn it.
I did mass.
I was trying to think of something obscene, but I didn't want to go that route. Oh, well.
Yes, I did click that button a lot for an hour. So yeah. It was that fun.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe we call it left click the game 3.
Yes.
Plus right click.
So I guess I'll start with everything non-game related this week. I went to St. Louis for work, but had enough time to explore the city and do other things. So
so it's the gateway to the west, right?
Yeah, that is.
Why isn't it also the gateway to the east? Because if it's a gateway...
Well, because you started
the
concept, in the east
it should
and
just be
west.
Relative
you
to where you are.
Moved west, not moved
If you
east.
Live in New York, it's the gateway to the west, but I live in San Diego, so for me, St. Louis should be the gateway to the east.
Well, part of the concept, I think, is that's where Lewis and Clark started their trip.
Really? They started
the
in St. Louis? Is that egotistical on Lewis's part? It's like, we're starting in a city named after me, motherfuckers.
Yeah, we're not starting in Clark, Indiana, or wherever.
I'm sure that's the order that happened, yes. So, holy Jesus, actually, that arch is an imposing figure.
Uh-huh.
I saw it when I was 7 or 8, and you don't really understand the scale of things when you're a kid. But when you see it when you're an adult, it is a sci-fi, crazy bullshit.
Is it a Stargate?
Structure.
It's a Stargate, isn't it?
It is.
The Stargate's like way smaller.
Stargate times a million, man. It is
the
so
Stargate.
Big, it's crazy.
It's the Stargate to the west.
It's a bit, but it, yes, it is a bit like Stargate. It's a bit like 2001 Space Odyssey, like, you know, approaching this big black pillar.
The monolith?
Yeah, the monolith or whatever. Yeah. You stand at the bottom and it's just, it's really imposing. It's like, wow. Anyway.
That's cool. I've never seen it.
Yeah, me neither.
I also tried like every famous St. Louis food I could.
St. Louis is famous for
food?
To
wit?
Well, I guess they're not famous for a lot of other
things. It's numerous barbecue joints that you tried, right? Isn't that basically what you're about to tell us?
Wait, isn't that the South, you mean?
I tried one barbecue place, but they have several other things they're well known for, such as Ted Drew's frozen custard. Which is basically
I've heard of this.
Soft serve.
I have had frozen custard in Vegas. That
but
shit's
it's
good.
Got egg in it. It's a little better, maybe. Toasted ravioli.
That's St. Louis related?
It's for some reason, it's a St. Louis thing, yes.
Toasted ravioli.
Prevelle cheese you can only get in St. Louis.
It's like a ravioli you can just pick up and eat
with
your
hands. It's deep-fried ravioli.
Yeah. Oh.
Toasted is a misnomer.
Toasted.
Prevelle cheese, which is this kind of processed white cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Like provolone or Swiss or something like that, but
so Subway
but
cheese.
A little bit closer to Velveeta or American.
Uh-huh. Okay,
right, somewhere in there.
Do you try it on something or just
they put that on pizza. So I tried it multiple ways on this thin like cracker like pizza,
uh-huh.
and also on bread melted or on pasta or shredded. Yeah, I did try it raw. It's all right.
So brave.
I've never met a cheese I didn't like. Anyway, and then I tried several
even like Limburger
there.
Or Brick? Those like
cheese,
super
man.
Smelly cheeses that are like make you gag?
Yeah.
Really? You're a fan of those? Like a big fan of those?
The
or
smellier
just...
the better.
So you like mold. Are you
basically.
Like, are you dirt?
Yeah, I like sour.
Are you a cave?
I like sour beer too, which is just bacteria.
All right.
Then
have
I tried...
you ever heard the cheese shop sketch, Monty Python?
That sounds familiar.
It's good. Look it up. Look up the cheese shop sketch.
It'll be in the show notes.
Yeah.
So they also, I did the brewery tour at Anheuser-Busch.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Wow. That is like, it's like going through a mall, which I find quite an experience because I don't like malls. They're just this extremely commercial,
right?
Like, you know, yelling at you to buy things sort of situation. Just walking through, that's what I feel like. Mm-hmm. That's what Anheuser-Busch tour felt like. It was this enormous commercial industry,
yeah,
like screaming. And I was with kids on the tour. There's like a busload of kids taking this tour. And I felt like they were just screaming at them to buy these like Tilt, like vodka, whatever cans, right?
They're just doing their part, Josh.
That was weird.
Afterward, they went to like the Smith & Wesson factory and then the, you know, gambling zone factory. Just take the school bus of kids from one vice to another.
I'm jealous. Yeah, that would have been
so
fun.
Contrast that with like the Stone Brewery, which you've been to a million times.
I've never done the full tour there, but I have done tours at several local microbrewers. Mm-hmm. And in general...
is it just the scale?
Microbrewery tours are cool. It's not just the scale, but yeah, it's the... personal, how personal it feels.
Mm-hmm.
There it felt like just big industry. You know, the guys giving the tour felt like they'd done it a million times, right, and were just spouting their lines and didn't give a crap. And
you can swear on the podcast, it's all right.
I don't, why I hesitate? I haven't said crap in years.
It's got an explicit tag, so go crazy.
Also,
no craps given.
I don't feel like they're in love with their product. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like at microbreweries, when they tour you around, it's like they love their product. Their heart went into it, right? It's a guy who's worked there for a while, and maybe he's close friends with the guy, with the head brewers, and mm-hmm. You know, at a place like this, it's like, yeah, this thing with rice in it, and like, here's the way we make it for you. Here's a bunch of Clydesdales. Aren't they pretty?
They are.
Right?
They're pretty.
Anyway,
pretty pony.
I also had time to read Hunger Games on the plane.
Like all three books?
Just the first.
Oh, okay. Thoughts?
It basically ripped off Battle Royale.
I know, it's Battle Royale,
it's Battle PG-13. But PG-13, exactly. It's all right. But it I can tell why it's really, really popular. But they definitely held back. It would have been a lot better if it were more adult.
Well, doesn't that already exist?
But
it's watered down.
Yeah, it already exists.
They didn't need to do that. That would have been pointless.
So, yeah, so they brought this pretty cool concept to the masses, so I guess that's a good thing. It's very predictable, and I do want to see what happens next, but I don't think the cool part is going to be until the third book. The really interesting part I'm looking forward to, I think, is
if Robin were here, she could tell you, but...
Anyway.
I saw the movie without ever having read the book.
Did you like the movie?
I thought it was fine, but it seemed, as Josh said, it seemed relatively predictable. Like, without ever having seen the movie, just sort of what I've absorbed from popular culture, I could have given you the basic plot beats from the whole thing.
And you've seen Battle Royale?
No, I haven't.
But you know what that is, generally?
No, I don't.
So it's like,
I know it is the more adult, more interesting Hunger Games.
It's the, disturbing Japanese version where they actually show the killing, and it's
no holds barred. Anime?
It's a movie.
Okay.
It's like a live action movie. It's no holds barred. It's very
Is it
disturbing.
Just like a deathmatch thing, or does it have the same like dystopian overtones?
Yeah. It's like putting kids on a island and they one by one, you know, murder each
other. But it's like in the dystopian future kind of thing, or is it just like this is happening?
I don't remember.
Because that's the point. It's not about the kids fighting, right?
I think
the
it's in a dystopian present.
Okay.
Like, it's in an alternate present where the Japanese government is all crazy.
Okay.
That's why they're doing that. So, yeah, very, very similar.
It has the same government, like, control, power. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't get deep into those issues. It pretty much focuses on the violence.
Right.
Yeah, that's...
But this book doesn't get into that either until maybe the third book.
Right.
Anyway... I'll read the rest of it. Games. Let's talk. Well, no. The city. Holy shit. St. Louis is such a weird city. I think what happened is they had this big booming economy in like the 30s, something around then, right? Mm-hmm. They built all these huge buildings. So everything is made out of brick. Everything is an enormous building made out of brick in the whole city.
Like the size of a city block, but four stories high.
No.
When you say enormous, it's not like a brick skyscraper.
There are brick, skyscraper. Well, like they're not skyscraper. Maybe
stories?
There are 10 or 12.
Yeah, that's pretty still tall made for out a brick.
That's a lot of bricks.
Yeah, yeah. but then there are just little houses that are, you know, that are one or two or three Bricklets. Or four stories high out of brick. Everything in the city is made out of brick. Mm-hmm. And everything in the Even city the looks like it was built a long time ago, like the 30s, mm-hmm. not just like 20 years ago. And here's the crazy part. Because I guess this is my assumption, the economy hasn't just grown and grown and grown since then. It dived and then it never fully recovered. So they're doing okay now, but it's never gotten as big as it was a long time ago. There are all these abandoned buildings mm-hmm. everywhere. So many abandoned buildings. Because there's also all these empty buildings that are for lease or rent or to own. And but unlike in San Diego or something where I guess we've just continuously grown over the years, if any building ever got abandoned, someone would be willing to buy the property, yeah. tear it down, and rebuild. Mm-hmm. But over there, no one has the incentive to buy and tear it down, so they just leave all these buildings.
When you live in a place like St. Louis where you can always expand, like this is what happened to Atlanta as well, it's cheaper to just build a new building on an empty plot of land than to demolish one that's already there and then build
right.
it. Right. In San Diego, you can't build out into the ocean. You can't build south into Mexico. North is Camp Pendleton and east is the desert. Right. It's one of the reasons we have such a ridiculously high price, you know, cost of living right. and real estate prices and all that stuff.
Now, I haven't done a ton of traveling, yeah. but I was thinking this can't be unique. This must be this way in a lot of cities. Mm-hmm. But how many cities have you seen like that?
Well, I know Detroit is like that. Like there are
yeah,
tons
that's
of,
exactly I what I was thinking.
A couple
of
those, yeah. yeah. I figured Detroit.
I would think a lot of Midwestern,
yeah, the kind
depressed
of Rust Belt
cities,
Pittsburgh,
yeah, you know. Or like stuff on Route 66.
Let's
even,
shit
maybe.
On some more Midwestern cities.
Well, I'm not saying they're horrible cities. I loved it.
Yeah,
the city was awesome.
So you're saying you wish San Diego had more random abandoned buildings all over the place made of brick?
You know what? It was super cool. I went around looking at these abandoned buildings. It was like the primary tourist attraction, in my opinion. I glance at
that's
the arch
quite the angle.
I am sure the Chamber of Commerce says, come to St. Louis, you know, visit for the arch, stay for the abandoned buildings,
stay for the brick.
They should, you know, because I spent a few minutes at the arch, but I spent hours like going around all these abandoned buildings. It was super cool. There was this armory that was built in like 1936. That building was so sweet. Where there were all these churches, like tall, amazing, epic churches stained glass and stuff mm-hmm. that were abandoned, surrounded by these burnt out brick homes that were like half collapsed and burnt out still, just all over the place in some areas.
Yeah, that's cool.
There was full-size hospitals. There's a full-size hospital that's boarded up and abandoned. Oh man, I wanted to go in there so bad. I was just thinking, you know, like zombie apocalypse right. movies. Like I want to go in there and see what's left inside.
Yeah, I was just about to say the next Fallout doesn't need to be in the distant future. It needs to be now in St. Louis, right. apparently.
Totally.
Just add totally. Some super mutants and ghouls and you're done.
And to contrast that, everything was green. There's just nice lush grass everywhere that's well trimmed almost everywhere too. Like the one thing the city pays for is to trim all the grass.
Did they get
or
a decent amount of rain?
I think it had a lot of rain, I think.
Is that
yeah.
why? Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm. That's how you do it. Grass always looks shitty. And somehow people in Southern California decided, like, we're going to do grass instead of we're going to do, like, native plants. And native plants don't take all this, you know, crazy watering, and they look just as good. But somehow it's like, no, we must have grass in the island between the, you know, two lines of cars everywhere, which drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm. It's like East Coast envy or something.
Yeah,
it's rain envy down
here.
It
is. Yeah. Rain
grass
envy.
Equals money down here.
Yeah.
But grass equals abandoned lot up there.
Yeah. It's like a lush lawn that somebody would pay huge dollars for over here.
It was really nice. Yeah.
Oh, speaking of that, this is sort of off topic. There is like crazy interesting stuff happening in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans. Have you heard this? Like, mm-hmm. since Katrina blew through, they basically have not rebuilt that whole ward or, like, major portions. And it is just being reclaimed. Like, the city has a team of people who go around. And it's kind of like the Golden Gate Bridge. Like, they paint it from one side to the other and then immediately start going back the other way. Like, they go around and they say, like, you have about 6 months before you have to go re-clear lots. Because there are, like, you know, alligators that are coming through and, like, people's homes and shit. And, like, the jungle is just taking back over.
Wow. Yeah, take that, humanity.
It is crazy interesting. And in sort of the kind of post-apocalyptic, or like there was that book, The World Without Us, which talks yeah. about like, yeah, what happens after the apocalypse or if all humans were suddenly gone.
That is happening right wow. now in New yeah. Orleans.
It is.
So games. I thought I wasn't going to have much time to play anything this week on the trip and stuff. When I fly on a plane, etc., usually all I ever play is Luminous and DJ Max on my PSP. But now I have a Vita, so I played a bunch of Luminous and DJ Max on my Vita. Both those games are rad.
Hi-o.
But I did get back and have a chance to try a bunch of stuff. We talked about Diablo. There was a Humble Bundle this week and a Indie Royale bundle. And the Humble was primarily Botanicula.
I've heard something about that.
We played Machinarium together.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, that game is great.
And so it's the next after those guys.
Oh, it's made by the same people?
Yeah.
Oh, so okay. That's a must buy now.
Yeah, so I want to play it with you. So okay. I bought it so we can play it together.
All right, done.
Sweet.
Wait, did you buy it on Steam?
I get no invite to this game.
You can play it.
All right.
Did you?
It's going to be awesome.
Was it PC or
360? It's like, I'm like, I want to play it with you.
Do you know what a Humble Bundle is?
Sorry, I forgot it was Humble Bundle, right?
So a Humble Bundle means, it means PC, Mac, and Linux, and sometimes Android. It's fucking everything, DRM free on everything.
Except for console.
You download it directly from their website. Or if you want, it's often like Steam keys for all those things too.
Cool.
But Indie Royale is really similar, except often Desura keys instead of Steam. So I installed Desura.
Desura? What the hell's that?
It's like a Steam competitor for mostly indie games.
I haven't heard of it.
It's all right. Simple client Steam. Works well. So now I'm running Steam, Desura, and Origin, Jesus. But one of the games in the Indie Royale bundle was called Inferno Plus by Radiant Games. I don't know if you guys have ever played any of the Radiant games.
Mm-mm. Like Radiant, what?
Radiant.
What do they make?
They're a studio that names all their games after themselves and then an arbitrary name, like Radiant Games Inferno Plus or whatever. And they have a bunch of $3 games, I think, on the Xbox Live Indie channel.
We've tried one.
And they're some of the highest quality things on the Xbox Live Indie channel. They're very, very good. They use the same engine, I imagine, because they all look almost identical. It looks like Geometry Wars with more curved edges and with a lot of bloom, with the bloom just turned all the way the fuck up. Really, really colorful, rounded Geometry Wars. Right. And then they use that engine to make all these different types of games. And they're doing stuff in all these classic genres. Some of them are more traditional dual analog shooters, whatever, like Geometry Wars. But some are like Breakout, and some are... anyway, this one is a dungeon crawler, but it's in the dual stick analog shooter
engine model,
right? So you're flying around this little ship, like shooting just like a bullet hell of bullets and dodging a bullet hell of bullets and exploring all these levels, going through hidden doors and finding upgrades and getting little ships to follow you and getting like repulsor shields. And it's so sweet, man. So I played that all the way through, beat it in the Royale bundle right now. Those games, oh my God, Radiant Games needs to put everything on the Vita, because everything they do is like dual analog and works really well for that. And the Vita needs more quality dual analog games because it has the sticks. And those games would be great, cheap, downloadable in that thing. They need to do that, seriously. And then I beat Fez, at least the first way through, mm-hmm. which made me want to play all these other side scrollers.
Mm-hmm.
So I finished VVVVV.
Nice.
Which I'd never done. That was sweet. And then started Swords and Sorcery because it just came out on Steam.
Sorcery.
Right. You know, I'm curious. I kind of thought that one of the main, conceits of that game is that it was on a touchscreen. So I didn't know how well that would translate to.
Touchscreen is just like a mouse for most cases.
Right. But I almost thought that was kind of like, I don't want to say gimmick, but it was one of those things where like, this game is cool largely because you get to touch the screen, and it's like a good example of a touch-based game. But so I was kind of curious.
I thought it used touch control as well, but I didn't think that was its sort of its calling
card. It's cool because the music is awesome.
The music is the
directing
thing I think
is awesome.
About.
The art is awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just weird because it started on an iPad.
Yeah.
And so that is kind of where I think, oh, it's an iPad game, so it's weird that it would go from there to Steam. I don't know why.
It's brilliant on PC.
Okay. Probably, I still haven't beat it. I got like halfway through it, and yeah.
Because I'm listening to it on surround sound, playing on a 47-inch TV.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. I understand why the touchscreen, you know, works well for it, but a mouse works fine. It's like a point-and-click adventure game.
It is a point-and-click adventure game.
Right, yeah. But it's a very simplistic one. Like, the goals and the actions you do in it are... Yeah. It's
well, it, you didn't beat it.
It's very...
I don't know how far you got. It gets... There's more stuff going on. There's
okay.
some sweet combat and stuff.
Well, I've played lots of combat, and the combat is... It's... Well, I don't know. It, the whole game seems very simplistic. It doesn't seem like...
How many
like,
triangles did you get?
How many... Well, I'm like the percentage-wise, you know, when it says you're this... I'm like at least halfway through the game.
Oh, okay.
So, I've seen a lot of it, but I never thought it was cool because it did, like... interesting things within the graphic adventure game beyond the fact that it had cool touchscreen stuff, but that it was atmospheric as hell. Like, the graphics were very interesting, and the soundtrack was very interesting.
It's a good
world.
So,
yeah. Swords and Sorcery.
All right, it's on me. Swords and Sorcery is good. I want to chatter about this book that I'm reading, which is called 1Q84. So 1984, but with a Q instead of a 9.
I never got that until now.
And it's by a Japanese author called Haruki Murakami, and it's translated into English, obviously. One thing
you
I wanted
didn't learn Japanese
say,
this week.
I did not learn Japanese to read this book. it has excellent jacket design. The cover and the jacket, the dust jacket for the hardcover. Is just it's just a beautiful object, this book. It's like the hardcover of the physical hardcover is one set of images, and then the dust jacket is a separate, it's like a translucent paper stock, and it has its own set of printing on it, and there's like an interplay when you have the jacket on and off, and it's just a really cool object. And the book is sort of about that. It's about kind of reality and unreality. It's I don't know exactly. I mean, it's just, it's fiction. It's set in 1984. It is in Japan. It's just really interesting. If I say anything more about what it's about, it spoils it. 'Cause you kind of don't get introduced to that stuff until a few chapters in, at least anyway. But yeah, it's just sort of about what's real and what isn't. And it's really fascinating. It's good. It's fun to read books written by people in other languages, especially if they've been translated well, which I believe that this book has, because just the way people write in other languages it's fascinating. It's like hearing somebody talk with an accent. It's just like a little bit different, and it adds something to the flavor of that. So I kind of enjoy that kind of thing.
That's why anime with subtitles,
has an
appeal.
Mm-hmm. Anime always
unique translation.
With subtitles, yeah.
So I should read it.
Yeah, it's worth reading. I definitely think it's worth reading. I'm 600 pages in, and it's probably like 2/3 of the way through, so it's a pretty lengthy book.
Should I get the ebook?
I don't know.
Is the cover
primary? I think you missed out on the beautiful art object that it is.
How primary is it?
He just said it was like, that's the whole book. It's that dust jacket, man.
It's as good as the dust jacket.
It's only as good as the dust jacket. I personally do not like reading stuff like on an iPad or iPhone or anything, a Kindle. I'm not down with that. I like to have the physical book.
Would you say that's like not your thing or something?
We could do that as not my thing, yeah.
All right, sure. You should save that. You should write that down.
Future not my thing.
Retract it.
Because, I have opinions about that.
All right. There were a couple rumors that got unrumored or got cleared up recently in the news, which I was psyched about. Well, one I was happy about, one I was bummed about. The one I was psyched about was that Prey 2 is not canceled.
Oh my God, it's not canceled?
It is not canceled.
It's just delayed.
It is delayed, but officially, like, there was...
Indefinitely!
The rumor came out that it was canceled, and I was like,
so worried
no,
it was canceled.
That sucks, because that game looked really sweet.
That video looks so
dope. Really interesting. So the developers... I forget, do you remember who develops that game? Who's doing it?
No.
Is that Epic?
I don't know.
Is it Epic Mega Games?
No, it's not Epic. Oh. They're not Epic Mega Games anymore. That was, like, Commander Keen era.
Whatever. You still know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, it's
Mega
not...
Mega Games!
It's, I forget who it is. No research. Phone down.
Yeah, no.
This is not
about learning stuff. This is about espousing opinions on the spot.
I would recognize the name of the company.
Yes, we would all know who they were if somebody could just say it. That's not canceled. It's just delayed. The one that I was bummed about was that it turns out that Tim Cook did not go visit Valve.
Ah, I did. I hear that.
Yeah, so there was a rumor. Josh apparently has not heard it.
Gabe said, no, this didn't happen.
That Tim Cook had visited Valve, and they were talking the rumor was essentially that they were collaborating
this
on
about the
Steam Box.
Okay.
Yeah, and that it was going to be wrapped into Apple's revolutionary new television product that we've been hearing rumors about forever, and that was going to be one thing. And that was like a super sweet and interesting rumor for like 10 minutes there. But then, like, you know, whatever, a day later, Tim Cook's office said, like, no, he never went. So, weak.
And Valve also released something. Yeah. Saying, yeah, I didn't, you know, Gabe was like, you were asking, did you meet with Tim Cook? I didn't meet with Tim Cook. Apparently, I didn't meet with Tim Cook.
There you go. Too bad. But it's kind of fun when, if you're CNET.com and you're like, we just want a million links today, so we're going to make up some totally fake story. What's the, you know, biggest piece of nerd bait we can possibly think of? Guess what, guys? Tim Cook went and met with Gabe Newell at Valve. And, you know, so that was lame of CNET. So screw you, CNET. Games.
CNET is, they're such jerks now.
Yeah, remember when CNET was like the news corporation you would go to? Didn't they own news.com, for God's sake?
I don't know.
Do you know download.com?
Yeah.
You know they wrap their downloads in spyware now?
Do they?
Or yeah. Is that legitimate?
It's not every single one. It's some of them. And they wrap it in their own program so that when you download the installer, it's not the original installer. It's like a CNET installer. Mm-hmm.
Does it phone home
that
or something?
Tries to install its own adware and then install the program. Now, there might be checkboxes or some way to get out of it, but the concept is there.
Yeah.
It's so
they should not
sketchy.
Do that.
That is the dark side.
That's bullshit.
Games. One final piece of non-games. Have you heard of BXX Haunted? Have you heard of this?
No.
This is the next project from Daniel Knauf. K-N-A-U-F, who did Carnival, the HBO TV show.
Oh, okay.
Right? So critically acclaimed. I never actually watched it, but I think people liked it. He did a project, this thing called BXX Haunted, which is not a good name. I don't know why it's called that.
Yeah, what the hell is that supposed to
be? It probably has some story significance if you get into it. But this is the concept is there's a haunted house, and a team of people go in, and they set up 32 cameras, they set up like 16 plus cameras and film for 32 hours, and then they just collect all this footage.
Is this reality or fiction?
This is a real thing that he did.
Okay.
The people are actors.
Chaz is making this story up as...
So they really set up 16 cameras in a house, and they really filmed for 32 hours, and then they just basically had people act out a play, and then they touched it up digitally to add in effects and whatever, but... It's totally nonlinear, and it's only available online, right? So it's not a movie. You literally have 600 hours of stuff that you can go piece watch through, and it's sort of like alternative reality stuff where there's, you know, forums of people saying, oh, I found a cool thing on camera 8 at, you know, this minute mark. Go watch that, and we'll piece it together and figure out how the story works, which I'm not sure if I like.
It
I like the
tedious
concept.
As
it does not
– as shit.
I don't like horror stuff, right? So I'm probably not that into it, but I like that people are doing stuff like this, which could only be done digitally,
so
could only be released on the internet.
They didn't edit it down at all?
It is not edited at all. It is 100% nonlinear. There's literally 600 hours of footage that you can...
But he's planning on editing it later.
I don't think so. This is how it was released. Like, the project is done and was released this way.
That sounds dumb.
It sounds like a pain in the ass, but I'm interested in the concept. I like that people are exploring... things that you can only do digitally.
The concept is interesting and unique, but it's such a barrier to entry for someone who's potentially interested.
Yeah.
You know, I that sounds interesting. I would like to watch some, but I definitely don't want to dig through 600 hours and go read forums.
I would never want
to know which, you know,
that's
time,
I think,
links I need to click through to look at that are interesting. If somebody's compiled like a really good list of,
yeah, that's what's
of here's
happen.
All the moments you need to jump to,
yeah,
and then there's some automated way to click to all those times, like YouTube, you can right click when it's halfway through YouTube and say copy link at this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that is so useful. I wish everyone on the internet knew you could do that, because they keep not doing it and then saying skip to this time.
Right.
So if there's some automated way to do that for basically outsourcing the editing to...
He's crowdsourcing the editing.
Right? If that's the case, then that would be super cool. Because I definitely don't want to sift through that shit.
And you know that exists, because that's what the internet does. The internet is an obsessive collective that will do all of the busy work that you don't want to do.
Yeah.
And some.
Yeah.
That's what's great. He knew that would happen.
Theoretically.
Oh, no, I mean, it will. If it hasn't happened already, it happens.
Optimistically, if people are interested.
I don't even think it's optimistic. I think it's practical. I think the internet has shown itself to be
definitely happen if the thing that you produce is interesting.
Right. But it can't be absolute crap. It has to be somewhat cool, but...
So, anyway, I just thought that was cool.
That's interesting.
So, games. I played a lot of Fez, which we already talked about, and maybe at some point we'll have a Fez spoiler cast. Or maybe if we all get stuck at the same point. Like, I have started taking notes on that game. I am to the point where I'm literally, like, going through
this. When was the last game you took notes on?
It's a long time, but I have started. Fez is good. The other game that came out recently is Trials Evolution, which is the sequel to Trials HD.
Which we all just played for about 20 minutes.
Before the podcast. Yep. It's basically Trials HD, but with a multiplayer mode and new levels and new environments. So if you played that game and liked it, then you will like this one. I like it. Mike is sort of lukewarm on it. Josh hates it. But we don't really need to go into that.
I like it. I liked the first one. I played it halfway through or whatever, but it was definitely one of those games that escalated in my dislike for it as I played. Mm-hmm. Halfway through, I hated it after it got hard.
Yeah, when it gets hard.
Basically when it got hard. But I was never in love with it enough to stick all the way through.
It's a specific kind of game. It's one of those...
The way that it's different from Meat Boy or Forza or something, which you were asking about, is that just the primary mechanic is shifting your weight forward and back. Mm-hmm. It's balance.
Yeah.
The primary interaction with the whole game is keeping your balance.
And throttle and brake.
Used to from other racing games and such.
Right. It's two axes, right? There's... balance left and right, throttle up and down.
You are right, but but one of the difficulties with those two axes is that they're almost like the same axis. They're parallel axes because when you throttle more, it makes your balance hard.
Yeah, it shifts your balance. Yeah.
Right?
They affect each other.
And you like balance things a little more than me in general. I mean, you like the strap thing on the rope.
Josh is talking about slacklining. I was trying to think of what video game you were talking about. Yes. Strap game. Yes, actually slacklining in the real world.
You know, and I find that fun to try to stand on for a few moments, or fun to stand on a basketball or something, you know, to an extent. But I don't want a whole game designed around just keeping the balance of this bike from not tipping over while it slowly moves forward over this impossible hurdle of barrels and shit, right? Mm-hmm. Forza is a lot better because you're going 100 miles an hour, you know, and you moderate your grip of your tires going around turns, right? You have to let up on throttle or not oversteer, understeer a little bit while you're going around turns. There's some room for error. Worst case scenario is you start to throw your back end out, and then you can try to recover from the fishtail, or maybe you go into the sand, and then you're delayed a couple seconds, right? And the worst case scenario in Trials is that you crack the guy's neck because you just flipped over.
Right? Yeah.
Trials is different from Super Meat Boy in that in Super Meat Boy you're moving left and right and jumping, and so it's really this very timing based, precise, holding right for a little while. It's like digital versus analog. You know, you're holding right, and then you press A, and then you go left A, left, right A, left, right, right?
Yeah.
And so it's very, very timing-based. And Trials is like moderating the analog stick of balance while moderating that trigger of gas.
The analog trigger.
Very, very carefully to keep your balance, which is pretty far removed from keeping your balance in real life for me, and that has just never clicked with me as much as the moderating the gas in Forza, or as much as the very, very timing based perfection repetition in Super Meat Boy. So they're very different, and so
I think that this goes to sort of fundamentally who you are as a gamer. Like, I think you, Josh, are completely, like, one of the first things we talk about when you bring up a game are the mechanics and the controls, and you like, you thought the worst thing about Bastion was that it lacked dual analog. Like, I think that is a huge thing. Mechanics are just really key to your enjoyment of a game. And, like, I put Meat Boy and Trials in exactly the same category in my headspace as games that are about mastering a set of controls and kind of progressing through a level. And really difficult challenge. They have a lot of the same attributes, which is, like, they both load incredibly quickly. Like, that's a key feature of that game. And, like, if it loaded slowly, you would just hate life playing either of them, right? So the fact that they load quickly, the, like, rapid checkpointing, all those things, they are squarely in the same category. But I think in your headspace, they're very different because of that mechanical separation. And if you just don't click with that, you know, that set of mechanics, I can definitely see why you wouldn't like it.
All those other aspects of a game that can be good, like Bastion is obviously good in many ways.
Yeah.
Even Diablo 3 is almost flawless in many ways, but if the primary interface of the game, or if there's one critical thing like that that is wrong for me, you know, it's almost like I'm a disabled gamer in a very specific way. Like, if I'm not good at the specific control mechanism, or I don't like it, if it doesn't feel like my play style, then it's a barrier to entry for me. So, for example, I would play Diablo 3 all the way through. Probably, maybe, I don't know if I'll pay $60 for it, but holy God, if they release that as a dual analog game for console or even for PC, if they just added that support that they said that they tested and was awesome. The producer said literally the control was quote better.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decided not to put that out in the PC release of the game. What is wrong with them? If they were to release that so that I could dual analog, walk one way, shoot the opposite direction to kite or whatever, I would love that game. I would be all over, like, pre-ordering that for $60. Mm-hmm. But they intentionally decided to make this a mouse click game where you can't, like, walk one direction and shoot the other and kite. Like, it's just they didn't make it the way I prefer.
Yeah, and you wonder why they make those decisions. Was it just, like, there were levels that didn't work if you could do that, or other design? What waterfall steps would have happened?
I'm thinking, ironically, because I'm talking about how it's a barrier to entry for me, they did it that way because it's a lower barrier to entry for most people.
Yeah.
It's more like a Facebook Farmville click game, right?
Yeah.
It's super easy for anybody who owns a PC to go buy Diablo 3 and then just use their mouse and click a lot. It's, like, super easy.
Yep.
Yeah. I didn't realize that, but yeah, that was definitely something that it felt like a throwback to just clicking on enemies.
It's a throwback to itself.
Yeah. Like, I remember clicking on enemies ad infinitum for dungeon level after dungeon level. And for some reason, I found that really, really fun in Diablo, like 10 years ago or something. And it was, you know, not super engaging on the Diablo 3 beta. Like, I wonder why.
I think it is fun, but it's not the same kind of fun that you get, the sort of deep satisfaction you get from beating a Trials level or a Meat Boy level, where, like, in order to beat that level, you have to be really good, and nobody is really good at left-clicking, right? Like, you can just play the game, and you will be good at, you'll be, like, 100% as good at it as you... You know, in hour one, as you'll be in hour 50.
Well, yeah. You're the one that defended StarCraft 2 the other week for best game ever. That's just the clicking. Clicking.
No way. No. That's, I mean, mouse is clicking, but your left hand is fucking 300 actions a minute.
Oh, that's true, too. Yeah. You're using a keyboard.
There's total mastery.
Well, yeah, because, like, Diablo, compared to that, to the dual analog, like Torchlight or something, it almost renders it more as an RTS. Like, you're giving commands to your dude to go over there and, you know, like, kick that guy's ass, as opposed to Torchlight or any analog game where, you know, the left analog is moving them. Like, it's like you have your thumb on your dude and you're literally pushing them where you want them to go, as opposed to saying, go there by clicking on it.
I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I was going to make that, like, a whole topic for me. When you have direct control over a character with your stick or whatever, a joystick or even, I don't know, a trackball or something.
Or the WASD.
Or even WASD. Yeah. You have direct control over a character, right? And when you're just clicking and telling someone where to go, you're more like a director. You're more like just managing this system.
You're a coach.
You're not really... Yeah, you're a coach. You're not actually
Let's go, little guy.
Interacting
go, buddy.
Directly with this unit.
Let's get a hand in, everyone.
And yeah, I'm the one saying I want the dual analog, but there are other people that said, please add WASD control to Diablo Online. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, but functionally that's the same, right?
It's very similar.
I actually WASD'd, like, unconsciously, not realizing that that didn't do anything. I'm like, I'm pressing, because if you press D...
Oh, when you were playing?
I think it brings up, like, a menu option or something. I'm like, wait, up that, menu that doesn't make any sense. Why did that happen? And yeah, I was like, oh, right, I just click on things.
I literally click where I want to go, and if there's an enemy under it,
he walks towards the dude, and I'm like... That, why was that so incredibly fun 10 years ago in Diablo 1, and now it's kind of like, cool. It's good, but whatever.
And not to dig too deep, but this is very helpful information if you're ever going to play more Diablo. You don't have to massive click fest. You don't have to like just spam that mouse
just one
button.
Just click and hold.
What you can do is click and hold, and then you hold like either the shift or the alt button.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the superior way to play. What happens when you do that is you're like auto attacking while you're not holding alt. You're running when you're not holding it.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you hold alt, your character stands in place, and that
that
click becomes repeated.
Yeah. That only works for range
initial
characters.
Attack. Works for melee also, because you're standing in melee range, but then swinging your weapon repeatedly or whatever.
You have to get to the melee range, though. Typically, yeah. I used that mechanic when I was playing like a ranger or somebody, and I wanted to stand back.
It works better for those, but it works.
Yeah, so it doesn't only work. So yeah. Okay, cool. We're going to move on to another topic, which is games journalism. This is one that I kind of feel strongly about in as much as I think that games journalism, quote unquote, is a total misnomer, and that is not what's happening. That only very recently has that actually started to exist, something that you could really call games journalism. I think everything that's existed until now has basically just been... A better term would sort of be enthusiast press, right? I think the whole system of reviews of games kind of... It's kind of useless, and I think that, you know, this goes to the type of medium that games are... Media that games is. I don't know how to pluralize that. the
damn you,
the
Latin.
Medium that games are. Just the because of that interactivity, a review of it, like basically any review you read, you know, somewhere in there it's going to be fans of the genre will find something to like here, right? And I just hate seeing that in a review because I'm like, you sort of invalidated your whole thing, like.
If you like this, you'll like this.
Yeah,
it's super
exactly.
Applicable like, though for games like StarCraft.
I know it's applicable, but at that point, it's like, why is there even a review if it's just like people who don't already like this don't like it, and people who do. And you know, I think the only if we compare it to something like literary review or review of films, I think that something one thing in particular that reviews of games or reviewers lack is that. Most, I think, film reviewers, for example, went to film school, right? And then out of film school, they went into criticism instead of into the film industry. And so there's like a shared syntax and a shared kind of they actually literally call it grammar, the grammar of filmmaking. That's a term in cinema. And so there's like this shared frame of reference that somebody who went to film school, just like Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, you know, like they went to USC film school too, and now they write for Variety. And so they have like, but there is no real equivalent. Somebody who goes to school to become a game developer becomes a game developer, doesn't then go into, so they never have the same level of understanding about what it took to make the game. And really kind of, I'm not saying I have this level of understanding either, but I have a little bit more just kind of coming from a technical background and understanding what it takes to, you know, to code pages and things like that, that the choices that are being made in the development of a game are, I think, like infinitely more complex and require the interaction of way more sort of moving pieces than go into like making a film. You know what I mean? And so because of that, it makes the reviewing totally just sort of bizarre and not necessary. Like, I think something that's way better as a form of a review isn't reviewing and giving a score to a game at all. I think something like the quick looks that Giant Bomb do is far more useful. It's like, here's 20 minutes of the game. You, person who's watching, can enjoy us playing through it and draw your own conclusions. Or like a demo, right, is infinitely more useful to me than a written review. And it almost doesn't make sense that they exist.
I understand your point about reviews. And the way that I'm thinking about it in my head is that right when games come out, a game like Dark Souls, for example, mm-hmm. that we'll get to, reviews are almost across the board like 90s or something. But they all mention how there's these all these things that might push you away, you know, some people might not like. And really what's more interesting is to 6 months later go and try to find those articles that are like these retrospectives mm-hmm. and these criticisms of these well-lauded games. And those criticisms are really what's more like a film review when you can find those. They're rare and they're harder to find.
Yeah.
Sometimes on Gamma Sutra or after those, what's the Game Dev Expo?
GDC.
GDC.
Yeah.
What do they call it when they go back and talk about a game a year later?
I know what you're talking about.
Oh, a postmortem.
Postmortems.
Uh-huh. Yeah, those are right. Great. I love those.
Whenever they do any of those types of things, that's really what's closer to film criticism, yeah. I think. And
really?
I'm really I do.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
They're more critical. Well, maybe not the postmortems, but maybe these other articles that I'm talking about that we occasionally find. That are more critical of these well-lauded things and talk about really what they did differently in depth as opposed to just covering it like, this was fun, this gets a 9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I see the postmortems as being, God, I'm trying to think of an analog to a film, the film world, what that's like. It's that's sort of like when you buy the DVD or the Blu-ray and they've got the, you know, behind the scenes, maybe like how this was made, like the people that went mm-hmm. into making it.
That's true.
But the game one is even more technical because, you know, they will often actually talk about like, say, the graphic engine and how they built it or how they worked on the memory management of whatever. And that's something that even like a behind the scenes movie thing, you would never get. You wouldn't get a treatise on, you know, the frames per second and how that, you know, made us change how we did this or whatever, you know, the technical, you know, the exact camera we used and why we used that one and why that's better than 10 years ago when we were using this kind of camera. You know, it's more like, here's the actors and here's what their favorite food is and stuff like that.
You're right. Really, what I meant was these articles that you usually only find on completely independent blogs mm-hmm. where it's just some random guy.
Not even a gaming-related thing. Actually, I'm going to reference something that's from a non-gaming blog when we talk about Dark Souls later.
All right. Yeah. Those types of sites are really what have the interesting criticism, usually months later.
Yeah, it's not the, like, we got this for review and we were allowed. That's the thing, is like, they're definitely not journalists, simply definitionally, because, like, all those sites take junkets, which, you know, for listeners who don't know what that means, that it's, Capcom just had an event in Rome. They had Captivate, which is their yearly, like, developer preview to all the news sites, and they fly everybody to fucking Rome. Like, if you get a free trip to Rome, you are no longer a journalist. Like, you're doing something else. Like, you're enthusiast press. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you write a better review, you know, 5 months later when, you know, the new Street Fighter comes out, but it just means that you're not a journalist. Like, you just aren't doing what a journalist does. There are certain very specific sites that don't take junkets. There are a couple of them. But I think the game journalism, which is pretty new that has just started happening, is like the Penny Arcade Report stuff. Ben Kuchera does stories on there that are not like that I think are actual journalism. I don't happen to know if they are if they take junkets or not, or if he goes to that kind of stuff, or if it's all completely independently funded. But the type of stories that he's doing there, or like Josh mentioned, the Gamma Sutra stuff, as opposed to what you see in, you know, GamePro, or the magazines. What was the biggest?
EGM, Game Informer,
those kind of stories.
GameStop's,
and then all the blogs,
magazine, essentially. Yeah.
The blogs that are just carrying like the daily news, like Kotaku, Joystick, etc. Like, that's not journalism.
So it sounds like you have a really, really narrow view or definition of what journalism is. I guess I've always had a much more general, not nuanced, but just a wider spectra.
You're thinking of coverage.
Yeah, well, okay, sure. And I guess it depends on what you think journalism is. And, like, you think that is, you know, okay, sure. I agree that, you know, a person who writes a review immediately after being flown to Rome by the developer, you know, is sketchy and kind of, you know, ruins their integrity. But, you know, if you can conclusively prove, and you said that doesn't necessarily mean they'd write a glowing article. It's not like they're being bought off necessarily, right. but their integrity is compromised when they do stuff like that. And I totally agree. I guess I'm just not sure if that, like, completely invalidates what they're doing or their use or, like, what I can get out of them. Like, it's sort of like, you know, asking me, would I never read a review by someone that I knew had been flown to Rome for some crazy development thing? Like, if I knew they were compromised in some way, does that now mean that I can't take what they say seriously at all? Or it has no use to me? Or if I was going to use the example of, like, a more indie site, which, I don't know, maybe that's up for debate, whether it's indie anymore, Destructoid. I remember Destructoid.com when it first started, and I remember reading the origin story from the site's creator, Nero, how he essentially, when he was, like, 8, made what is now Destructoid, like, you know, in his bedroom. You know, he loved playing games, he loved talking about it with his friends, you know, he got out a bunch of sheets of paper and, you know, decided to, I'm going to make this game review thing. I'm going to make a club. This is going to be awesome. All my friends are going to love it. And then, you know, like 20 years later, he actually tried to make it a reality and he actually tried to become legitimate. And he basically just wrote a lot of stuff, a lot of reviews, a lot of stories, and sent them out like resumes, you know, shotgun style to as many people as he could to get, you know, picked up. And, you know, eventually just started making his own site, but kept, you know, sending these articles that he was writing for his site to try to seem legitimate, tried to get into, you know, E3 and maybe GDC or something. I don't know if that was even around when they started. And slowly but surely became legitimate. And I think now I would rank on the same level at least as Kotaku. Mm-hmm. Except, you know, you're saying that they're, Kotaku is not journalism, and so that must mean Destructoid is not journalism. Or at least that's how I view your opinion. But I don't know.
I think
Josh, you're gesticulating.
I think calling these sites or these folks like not journalists is maybe going a little too far. If you compare it to the film industry, in the film industry, there's this almost very very black and white delineated line between enthusiast press and mm-hmm. criticism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think of one of those Hollywood rags where they're showing you the behind-the-scenes shots that their paparazzi got on the set of Dark Knight or whatever, or the new Batman, whatever the new Batman is, you know, those are obviously in a completely different category than a review of a film after it came out at Chicago Tribune, mm-hmm. right? And so, I mean, you could say that that guy who did that review is a journalist and the article writers and photographers for the other thing, you could say they're not journalists, but I think that's being a bit harsh. I think maybe you just call them, I like the separation between the phrases enthusiast press,
yeah,
which is still press, versus legitimate criticism. Mm-hmm. And in games, we don't have as much of a hard line between that. Almost everything is enthusiast press,
yeah,
and almost nothing is criticism.
Yeah.
Right. Occasionally, you will find a legitimate criticism on like a random indie blog, but it's almost never from one of these big ones. I do think that the review system is completely broken.
Well, I think that
but I wouldn't say that they're non-journalists.
They definitely are. Well, yeah, I think on the specific issue of junkets, like if you take a junket, you're not a journalist. You aren't.
Even
like,
that, you are compromising your integrity for independent criticism. But it doesn't mean you're not a journalist, right?
It does. Like, literally just the definition of it, it does. Like, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, if you go to any major newspaper, they do not accept junkets. They don't. And
What about White House Press Corps flying on Air Force One?
That actually is something that people have taken issue with. Like, there are legitimate... you can have that discussion.
Right, you can have that discussion, school. But it's not a really obvious black and white, these guys aren't journalists.
Okay. Well, so I think semantics, the definitional issue is aside. Like, I think on the specific issue, and like I said, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be biased one way or another, but it opens you up to the possibility, and there are people who use it that way. Like, there are people in film criticism who are called, like, cover quote whores, or there's some term for people, like, box quote whores. Like,
Kotaku does it now in the reviews. They choose two quotes and they put them in the corner.
Yeah.
And they're like, here's your back of box quotes.
There, like, you go. Joke. Like, exactly. It's like, if you want to, there are people who will just, like, the studios will always fly them wherever because they know they're going to get a good quote out of this guy. And they have, like, a worse reputation in the film criticism. Like, they're known for that. Right. And I think that, especially because once you start taking that, it's not that the developer is buying a good review with your free trip to Rome, but they are buying some degree of control over what goes, the editorial content of what you produce. And, you know, maybe I have stronger feelings about this because I come at it from the journalism side. I was, you know, a college journalist. My wife actually wrote for a major daily newspaper. But that stuff, like, if as soon as they can say, like, you're allowed to write about this and this and this, but not this and this, which is true, right? Like, certain details of the game are under embargo until these dates, right? Like, yeah. They are managing a PR machine by doing that, and they get to do that because they flew you to Rome.
I think it's a really similar corollary, the White House press corps. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do hear things off the record that they aren't allowed to print.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like the difference between off the record.
Yeah. And that's a real thing that needs real to journalists. Be there. That's a real thing that needs to exist, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think when I think of, like, you know, you're basically saying they stop being journalists and they become marketers.
You they're
know,
part
the, of, they're part of the marketing yeah, team. You know, yeah. They're part of that. They're on the same level as, like, the posters and the advertisements and the videos that get posted to, you know, they become Nintendo power.
Right.
You know, they're no longer, you know, I mean, the one website that you guys haven't mentioned yet that specifically doesn't do reviews. And I think they even wrote an article about it where they explained why, is Killscreen. They're kind of up there with the, like, you know, I feel like they're a little more legitimately mm-hmm. criticism website, and they're not so much like what's hot this week.
Yeah.
You know, they're not GamePro, which yeah, Kotaku is essentially like the internet's GamePro. But yeah, I mean, I feel like we're really arguing over semantics here, over whether they get to whether they get the lauded title of
maybe
journalist
we should just forget
or not.
That
like how much
it?
Power does that really have? Like, what use is it to really debate whether you can call Kotaku journalism or not? Like, I'm still going to read them because they're really useful and they give me lots of information that I wouldn't get anywhere else or otherwise. And it's yeah. not like they're outright lying to me in every story or something.
Yeah, I'm not
or being
sure.
bought off in every story.
I'm not sure if it's a problem with the industry, but it's certainly like a direction the industry has gone is that you really need to do make your decisions about purchasing before the game even comes out. In order to get in on all these pre-release exclusives, right? Or pre-order bonuses, right? So you do have to follow Enthusiast Press to an extent just to know which games you're going to get before they come out, just so that you can not miss out on exclusive content and such. So it's kind of this weird problem where you can't wait until after it's come out. And
well, you can. And you don't have to buy games the moment
criticism.
They come out. I mean,
yeah, you do.
I don't know. I think that's one of the things where I often don't buy. I used to day one game buy a lot. I remember, like, was it Mortal Monday and that kind of stuff, you know, where you, not that I'd wait in a line, but I would be ready to go down to Electronics Boutique and frickin' pick up, you know, Mortal Kombat for Super Nintendo, you know, sweat colored blood and all, whatever. But yeah, I don't do that anymore. And that's a whole nother concept of the paradox of abundance. There's too many effing games out there that I literally don't have the ambition to care about every single one of them that much anymore.
But don't you think the industry is different in that more people are buying games on day one and making that decision ahead of time and pre-ordering to get bonuses and that sort of thing, as opposed to the film industry where people wait and, I mean, some people go the first day or the first weekend, but they often
like midnight showings.
They often wait a little bit for some reviews to come out and or for word of mouth recommendations. I think it's just percentage thing, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, sure, yeah. People wait. I like to get reviews on stuff. I like to find out whether other people thought it was good or not. And that's mainly because... And that's the difference between when I was six and buying games. You know, like, there weren't that many games coming out. There was the Nintendo, and that was pretty much the only thing that mattered. And, you know, it's not like there was 20 games coming out every week. And I needed a source to help me separate the wheat from the chaff. That wasn't an issue like it is now, just because gaming is so much bigger and it's more mainstream and there's more people caring about it. So there's more companies making more games to, you know, to feed that need. Like the, so yeah, it's very different. And, but I don't, getting back to the topic of
just basically, like, maybe we need to just forget about the whether or not you're a journalist, you know, kind of definition type argument, more focused on, I think that a lot of what gets written or has in the past gotten written has been really fluff. Like, if you do want to call it journalism, it's the most puff piece, like softball questions.
Right. You know, sure.
Not useful journalism that you can think of.
Well, and okay, not useful, but like, you know,
like not good.
Well, yeah, and I think also it has a lot to do with the subject matter. Like, what is it about the game that is it that you wish that these articles were saying that they're not?
Well, I think like the coverage.
What
like,
dirt are they supposed to be digging that they're not digging?
It's not a situation where, like in real journalism, there's like serious investigative pieces that can be done. But there is some of that, and there has been really good work. Like there was a great article. I don't even remember what the source was. This was several years ago, but it was sort of about everything that happened at id and kind of the rise and fall of that studio. Right. Mm-hmm. And the super like late 90s broham, like Todd McFarlane type culture with John Romero and Carmack and these kind of 20 something guys who get super rich and successful. And, you know, there's interesting kind of more investigative type pieces that you can do. And I think the example that I keep calling out is Penny Arcade Report. I think they're really doing, Ben Kuchera is doing really interesting pieces, even on specific games. Like, he didn't do a review of Fez, right? But he did a really interesting piece that included some interview with who's the guy? Phil Fish. Yeah. Included some interview with him and, you know, gave, you know, impressions and gave you kind of a sense of what the game was without putting a score on it and without saying, like, fans of indie platformers need look no further than Fez, you know?
You know, and
I think there's a way to do it well, and some people are starting to do it, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I appreciate it too, and I think this is one of those things that will unravel itself as time goes on. I think gaming is young, and it just wasn't taken seriously. It wasn't legitimate, and it's becoming more legitimate every day, and thus more people are taking it seriously, and thus more people are like, oh, it's not just some underground thing that where I'm going to put a zine out about for all my friends, you know, like Harvey Danger style. You know, it is something that is to be respected and like, oh, wow. You know, Koji Kondo actually wrote some really interesting music, despite the fact that it was done with like, you know, a square wave and a noise channel. You know, and it sounds horrible to most people, like, we shouldn't take it seriously. No, we should. Like, oh, look at the music. Don't look at how it was made. Don't look at how the music was presented, which is in this game that was ostensibly for kids that no adult would give a shit about. No, like, take it seriously, because there is something, there's meat there. And, yeah, so I think it's something that will just, it's happening. It's going to keep happening.
And it is super weird that you even need to bring up that concept, but it is true that games aren't fully respected in society yet, and yet they're making more money than films, right? Yeah. The industry is enormous, but it is still kind of young. So even though it's like it's bigger than the film industry, it still doesn't have the same level of respect, maybe just because of its age or its association with.
And it's definitely kids. Getting there. It's definitely getting there.
It's getting there, and Penny Arcade Report is going in the right direction, mm-hmm. for games journalism. I agree with your basic concept that there is too high of a percentage of the puff pieces, and it is a problem of, you know, compromised integrity with taking junkets or, you know, journalists are getting blacklisted when they leak information, the game companies didn't want them to,
yeah.
even when they obtain it legitimately.
And the separation, I mean, the classic problem in journalism forever has been the separation between advertising and editorial. And like, there was the whole Jeff Gerstmann thing with Kane and Lynch and GameSpot and all that. I mean, the line is just completely blurred, and it takes that separation. Like in most major newspapers, they're like either on two floors or sometimes in completely separate buildings, like the advertising sales department and the editorial people. So I'm not, obviously games, you know, games journalism isn't to that point yet. It's getting better. I think there are some problems with it. And a lot of it I find frustrating because I'm like, this isn't what yeah. I want. I want a more interesting, more in-depth piece of writing. And yeah, like you say, the
Penny Arcade Report.
No, the industry, the hobby is growing up and it is becoming
yeah.
more mainstream.
Yeah, and you know, it's just because film is older and more respected doesn't mean that people don't give scores to movies. I mean, come on, Ebert is known for stars and or thumbs up. I mean, that's the separate issue. I mean, you're not saying that like giving a score to a game is like a fruitless endeavor, and
I kind of think it is. Frankly, I think
so. Are giving stars to movies also fruitless?
A little bit, just in the sense that you basically have to find somebody you like. I think a site like Metacritic is totally useless. I find the concept to be completely ridiculous. Like, I think if you find a reviewer whose taste, through reading many of their reviews, whose taste you agree with, then their number can be relevant to you. But I think that, you know, just aggregating the reviews from like everywhere ever doesn't make a lot of sense. It basically gives you that sort of tyranny of the masses thing, which is, you know, it's something that you try to avoid in other facets of life. So it's like, I don't want to just know what most people think. I want to know what the people who think like I think.
So do you,
or whose opinions, you know, I tend to agree with.
Do you not use like reviews on Amazon to choose between like-minded products?
That's a
masses aggregate.
The functional capability of a product as defined in an Amazon review is different than something where it's all about your opinion, right? Where it's all about what you like and don't like. Like, I don't like products that don't work. And if there's, you know, 50 reviews, one star that says this fucking thing doesn't work, like, that's relevant.
Well, it's where I see your point, yeah. And it's valid. Although I don't know. I don't always agree with like the reviews that people put on products, and I think your opinion that X is bad and this whole thing is flawed because is bad, you know. And if you know that's not necessarily what I think, and mm-hmm. so it's still finding an individual, like you said, who agrees with you. You're trying to find
or for whom the same things are important. Yeah.
So we are digging a little deeper, maybe into a different topic we want to save for later. But Metacritic. I disagree that there's absolutely no place for it. I do agree with your general concept that you don't use it a lot or like, you know, think it's very useful in helping you decide whether or not you'd like a game or something. But to compare it to film, there are aggregators that are dramatically different that are useful for different reasons. Like at imdb.com, mm-hmm. The user reviews there are very, very populist.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, whether or not the masses like this. And so that's really interesting to go look at that score and then compare it to Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And Rotten Tomatoes has two different scores. They have the
top critics and users.
Yeah. And their users are actually still very, very different from IMDb's users. Mm-hmm. But what's even more dramatically different is that the critic average at Rotten Tomatoes is often dramatically different than the IMDb user
mm-hmm.
average, because that's like the masses' opinion, and Rotten Tomatoes is like the more critical or maybe even more highbrow or elitist
yeah.
opinion, right? And like personally, I tend to agree more with the Rotten Tomatoes average and not like the IMDb average mm-hmm. as much, but I know that there's a place for both.
Yeah.
You know, I find it useful to reference.
And I think that the Metacritic is just critics, right? There is no, I don't think.
Yeah. And we already discussed how the average critic is kind of broken for games. And so and there's only like one source. The Game Rankings is almost identical to Metacritic.
So that may actually be a good segue into another topic, which is our best game ever. And I won't spoil it for Josh, but there is, something interesting to say about criticism and Metacritic scores as relative to the game that we're going to talk about. So, Josh, what is your best game ever?
All right, so I need to nominate Dark Souls for my first best game ever.
Woo!
Because
Josh's hands are in the air.
Done.
It has
been nominated.
It has had the strongest effect on me, I think, maybe of any game I've ever played.
Any game ever.
At the moment, I mean, it is recent, so I could.
No.
It's hard for me to make absolutes like that.
Except because you just sort of did, but okay.
But, I mean, at this point,
in recent memory, this is the thing.
At this point, it feels accurate because it was recent and it was severe. And I don't remember anything that severe in the past. So, I don't know. Neither of you guys have played it. And I did play it all the way through. It took me 60 hours. I don't know how much I should focus on the concrete, like, playable aspects of the game. But the primary gist of the game and why I liked it is that it's challenging. And, you know, games in general are all about, or not all, but one of the great things about games is overcoming maybe a feeling of powerlessness or ennui that you might have in real life. They give you a way to control your destiny and to overcome challenges and succeed. And so, in general, in a lot of games, I really look for this level of challenge that is enjoyable, that, you know, the way that you approach the challenge is enjoyable, and then that I am able to pass or exceed, you know, to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And this game does it better than any other game for me because it is very, very challenging, and yet I feel like I'm very, very good at it, or at least I got good after enough practice, right? And I do think that most people would have the ability to overcome it. I don't think it's so hard that that most people wouldn't be able to succeed. But it does require a few things out of you, so it isn't for everyone. It requires persistence in the face of failure, and
so Super Meat Boy.
It's similar to Super Meat Boy.
Like, die a lot, but keep going back at it.
Yes, but the pacing is dramatically different.
Hmm.
You know, in Super Meat Boy, you can be stuck on one tiny little thing and try it literally 100 times in a row and die every time and then finally just get past it by doing it right. I never found myself in Dark Souls in a situation where I was dying at the same place repeatedly for very long. If I died once or twice, if I died twice ever in the same type of spot, I would reapproach my strategy. There is enough flexibility in the system. It's much more more complex than Super Meat Boy. You don't have this one critical path that you absolutely have to make every jump perfectly, right? There is enough variability and complexity for you to have different strategies, to approach from different angles, to try different things. You know, if you do get stuck, you can go somewhere else and get stronger. You can do the grind. That sort of thing. You can just, maybe you're not supposed to go that way yet, and you go a different direction and pass a certain thing, get a better weapon, get more armor, and then resume where you were stuck before and realize now it's a lot easier. So it has those classic RPG elements that make it a lot more complex in terms of its challenge and then you overcoming the challenge. But that's the primary reason that I love it so much. It asks you to do something that seems impossible. It gives you a weak little skeleton or knight, and it makes you fight them, and they dominate you maybe in like one hit. And you can find a way to return to that guy and defeat him, even if it doesn't involve going somewhere and grinding and coming back. You can just try again and try a different strategy, and you can beat him, right? And when you overcome that challenge that you thought was impossible, but then you did it, you feel so good.
Mm.
It is amazing. And they do this not just in the combat. They do this in the environment. They ask you to walk over these skinny platforms that you get really scared you're going to fall off. You're on these tight ledges everywhere you go, almost in the whole game. You can fall off to your death, you know. And then they start wiggling those platforms You're like, this is impossible. This is so hard. And then they make you jump off a wiggling skinny platform and land on another wiggling skinny platform. You know, stuff like that. That's just, I can't believe they're making me do this. Like the quote is, are you, the feeling that I feel in that situation is, are you fucking kidding me?
Right.
Right. This seems impossible. But when you overcome those things that feel impossible, there's nothing like it. They do that in so many ways. There's a situation where it's like pitch black and you can't see anything at all. Like not 1 foot in front of you. And you realize that you can use a lantern, but the only way to hold up your lantern is you put it in your hand instead of your shield. And if you don't know anything about this game at all, you know, the shield is so unbelievably critical to almost all the combat. 90% of the game, you are holding that shield button with the left trigger up, right? You're holding it in front of you when you go over every turn, around every turn, when you're going down every path that it's the first time you're there, because you don't know where the enemy spawns are yet. So you're holding your shield up just in case somebody jumps out from the darkness and attacks you. So in this super dark dungeon where you have to hold up a lantern instead of your shield, then it only expands the radius that you can see by like 3 or 4 feet. And so when you see like glowing eyes from reflecting off the lantern a few feet from you, you freak out and you switch back to your shield, and then you're fighting the skeleton
in the dark,
in complete darkness, but at least you know where he was, right? Which direction he's coming from. Or you keep the shield out and you just have to dodge. Or sorry, you keep the lantern out and you just have to dodge. But every time you swing your weapon, you put the lantern down for a moment. So even if you're holding the lantern out the whole time, each time you swing, it is getting completely dark for a second while you're swinging. Wow. It is, oh my gosh. But even that, like, super doable. Once you figure out how to do it, you know, and you get over your fright and you work out the lantern situation, oh my God, you feel like the best, like the most powerful being in the world. You feel like you are...
Once again, Josh's arms are outstretched in an upwards motion.
I can't emphasize that enough. I mean, I could talk about how even the weak enemies at the very beginning, these weak little skeletons, are super challenging in a very good way. And no enemy is completely trivial all the way through the game. And so that makes every moment of the game super interesting, and none of it gets like a boring, repetitive grind. The bosses have like this absurd variety and creativeness. There's so many different bosses that are really, really cool in so many different ways. But I don't have to talk about each one. There's, because also I want to avoid spoilers. It's a type of game that works particularly well for me personally in terms of exploration of the world. In a game like Fallout or Skyrim or whatever, I can play that game a decent amount, but I'll get really, really, as we talked about, I'd hate myself after a while of picking up all the cheese wheels and coins, right? But in a game like this, I can explore every nook and cranny in the entire game. It's totally doable.
Are there any collectibles? No fucking potion there to help you anyway?
Two questions. You do find super interesting shit at the end of secret tunnels and stuff. You don't find like all this useless bullshit. What was your?
I was saying, are there collectibles?
Yes, there's, and the one way that they're not punishing at all, that's just so brilliant, is that you have infinite inventory space. So infinite carry weight. So everything you pick up, I was carrying around like a dozen sets of armor near the end of the game, and switching my armor on the fly depending on what I was about to attack, at different bosses and stuff. You know, you put on your high plague resistance outfit, or you put on the maximum damage resistance heavy armor and move slower. You change your class on the fly, basically, just by equipping heavy armor. You move slow, right? And then you equip really light, like cloth, and then you can jump around like a rogue or whatever. So that's cool. There's so many different... The multiplayer is also really, really brilliant. Before you ask a question, last thing. Folks leave messages on the ground, and that's the primary interaction with other people. It's almost like an MMO in that you're playing online and interacting with people, but you only occasionally actually enter someone else's parallel world or have them enter yours. And so somebody can randomly enter your world when you're in human form and attack you. And so there's that PvP element. If you want to avoid it, there is a way to avoid it. You just stay in soul form. But if you find that fun, and I didn't get super into it, but I did kind of max my character pretty decently halfway through. And so I stayed in human form, hoping someone would invade me. And someone did invade me, and they looked super badass. They came at me with this weapon I'd never seen, and they swung it, you know, and I dominated them. And I was so proud. I was like, fuck yeah. And then I didn't PvP for a while after that, because it was really scary. But there's also co-op occasionally. So if you do meet a challenge that you can't overcome, or you feel stuck at and you don't want to go somewhere else and come back or try different strategies or whatever, you can just get somebody to join you and help you out. And they will show you a new technique, or just having two people, you know, coming at something from a different angle can make it easier. But it's really the way that they've integrated the multiplayer is brilliant and unique also. All right, let's move to questions.
So, you know, in preparing for this, neither Mike nor I have played this game. But so, you know, Josh, I think you think it reviewed, you might think it reviewed more poorly.
No, I did check the reviews. It reviewed very well, but every review you read says all these things that are negative about it in it, and references how it's not for everybody. Yeah. And so maybe it's a problem with reviews. Mm-hmm. In today's review landscape, like we were discussing, you know, it gets 90s. Yeah. It got a 90 average or something like that, right? But if it, in the film criticism world or something, you know, there is enough hate for it, enough negative aspects of it.
I mean, I think the primary thing that people dislike about this game is that it's hard. It's like really hard, right? It's quite difficult. That the developer was, you know, I think I don't know who the developer was. The main guy
from.
Well, it's from software, but then there was like a main, like Mizuguchi type
dude
who was behind it, whose brainchild it was. And he's been quoted as saying, like, my games are explicitly masochistic, right? Or players of my games should be masochists or something like that.
To some extent, that's PR, though. Yeah. Because it isn't really as masochistic as everyone says. Yeah. Even me describing it, I may have made it sound really masochistic or really, really difficult. But it isn't. It's at the perfect challenge level, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. It challenges you more so than all these dumb, easy games that you just blow through, that anyone, including your mom, could blow through, even though they're not a gamer, if they just sat down and did it, because they handhold you so much. This is a game for gamers, yes, it's for, you know, relatively hardcore gamers that can play a 60-hour RPG, action RPG, right? You have to be able to use the dual analog sticks pretty well, and have timing, but... As in, you know, it's like Infinity Blade timing to some extent. You have to figure out when to block and when to attack, you know. So it's this a little bit of trial and error, like as evident, you know, since Mike Tyson's punch out, sort of thing. But it is a bit deeper than that. And then a lot of it's really about the mood. They're scaring you into thinking something's impossible with the darkness, with the platforms. It's really not that hard. You can get through all that.
Right.
And it's really not that punishing either. When you drop all your souls or whatever, they don't mean that much. I played through almost the whole game at zero humanity level, even though you get bonuses for being higher. I played in soul form and with humanity zero for almost the whole game because I'm a hoarder. So I had like 50 humanity saved up as items that I never used. If I was a normal person, I probably would have used a bunch more of those.
And then been more in the kind of sense of fear about having it or not.
Yeah.
A little bit more in that survival horror sense.
And then the souls, like, yeah, if you drop them, you have a chance to go back and recover them from your corpse. And there are like money and XP. And so you do feel like if you lose a bunch of those, you feel like I just wasted time, or that was a, you know, complete failure. I just wasted an hour or something. But you didn't waste an hour because... More than other games, during that hour, you learned a lot, and you personally skilled up a lot. Like, you got better. You improved, you learned tactics, you memorized spawn points and situations. you know, you learned something about the boss when you died that you're going to try to avoid on the next attempt. So more than other games, like, you're legitimately skilling up. Whereas, you know, typical grindfest RPGs, you want your number to go up. You don't actually get any better.
Right.
You don't get better at clicking A, attack.
Yeah, and the enemies are just scaling with you, or you're getting to the enemies that are harder, and now they're hard too.
Yeah,
I know what you mean. So I like a hard game, as we've just talked about, you know, Trials for a long time. It's sort of punishingly hard in kind of some of the same ways. And most of the people who review it poorly, like on an Amazon review, like a negative user review, usually centers around, like, why is this game so hard? The one review it's not a review. This is a piece of journalism. There's a guy called Michael Thompson from Slate who wrote one of these pieces that we were talking about. You're nodding like you've read this piece. Have you? Okay. I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs. And like we talked about in the journalism discussion, this is a piece from a source external to the games industry, right? And I think it's a better piece of journalism. Anyway, it's an editorial. But the two paragraphs I wanted to call out, which were kind of the only more legitimate criticisms of it as a game than what I was able to find, other than just that it was hard, right? So he says, "What no one talks about when they praise Dark Souls is what it means, what immemorial questions of human nature its difficulty and disorder evoke. Instead, the game is good because playing makes you feel good, and that goodness is amplified by the recent memory of having been very, very bad at the game, of taking wrong turns and missing attacks against zombies. Think of Dark Souls as a self-esteem kit for people who can take marching orders from giant talking snakes without withering a little inside." There is, I don't know if that happens, do you get ordered around by snakes? Is that a thing in the game? I assumed he was referencing part of the game with that.
Say that snake part again.
Think of Dark Souls as a self-esteem kit for people who can take marching orders from giant talking snakes without withering.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so he's referencing part of the game.
Yes.
So next paragraph. "There is real beauty in Dark Souls. It reveals that life is more suffering than pleasure, more failure than success, and that even the momentary relief of achievement is wiped away by new levels of difficulty. It is also a testament to our persistence in the face of that suffering, and it offers the comfort of a community of other players all stuck in the same hellish quagmire. Those are good qualities. That is art. And you can get all of that from the first 5 hours of Dark Souls. The remaining 90 or so offer nothing but an increasingly nonsensical variation on that experience."
Right. I remember reading that now a few months ago. You are correct in the sense
that... I'm not,
he is. No. In the sense that seems like more legitimate criticism.
Yeah, of the game.
Compared to regular
generally,
reviews.
Yeah.
But to me, it does sound kind of just like a very eloquent way of saying that the game wasn't for him.
Uh-huh.
His criticism is basically applicable to all games. He's saying, you know, the game rewards you in this insulting way, where it gives you a challenge and then you overcome it, and mm-hmm. then you feel good about yourself. That he's basically insulting all games in that sense, because he's coming at it from like a film critic mm-hmm. position or something who doesn't usually game.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know if he does or not.
But yeah. But doesn't it sound like that?
I don't...
You could make that criticism about all games, right?
When I read that article, I basically felt like these are the two strongest discussions or arguments against it that I found, and they're not really right. that strong. Like, I don't actually agree with either of those just because he's basically saying, like, it's long, right? You can get what it has to teach you in 5 hours, and maybe he's right about that, but that doesn't mean that there isn't fun to be had,
yeah.
right? Like, his kind of statement is true if in the game weren't fun yeah. to keep playing.
He's basically saying the ratio for him in the first 5 hours was too much pain compared to not enough reward.
Mm-hmm.
And he's accurate in the sense that in the first 5 hours, you can figure out what the ratio is going to be for you for the rest of the game. So if you don't enjoy the first 5 hours, then I wouldn't recommend you stick through it. But I enjoyed the first 5 hours immensely. And so
mm-hmm.
obviously if you did, you should stick through it because it shows you just a bunch more variety and awesome bosses, awesome enemy types, sweet loot, really beautiful areas, more so than Demon's Souls, the area variety, the environments.
The prequel.
Yes. Well, unofficial prequel.
Mm-hmm.
The environment types are really, really stunning at times, even like 3/4 of the way through the game, or even at the very end, you're encountering dramatically different areas. that are really stunning and new enemies. It's super cool.
Mm-hmm. Mike, do you have any thoughts
on it? You guys need to play it.
Well, as Charles said, I have also not played this game, so I don't really have a lot to say about it specifically. I think you saying it's a game for gamers, which, you know, sounds really elitist, you know, like if you just leave it at that, but
you're not hardcore enough.
Yeah. Like, you know, if you don't, you know, chew up, you know, most games for breakfast, you know, you're going to get your ass handed to you. It's funny that you said that, that the PR of that, it's, you know, really hard, that's more PR than truth. And then it immediately thought of, it's coming out on PC in a few months, and it's called like the,
You Are Dead edition or something.
Yeah. Or Expect to Die edition or something. Yeah. Like you will die, or, Prepare to Die or something.
Prepare
like that.
To Die, yeah, I think
prepare that's to die. Prepare to Die edition. I'm like, okay, well, yeah, PR or not, obviously he has an angle and an agenda, or the company has an agenda that they're trying to push, that their game is going to be known because it's hard. Even though Josh has been sitting here saying that, okay, it's not really that punishing, even though I think that's their whole shtick, is that the shit is hard. Be ready. You're gonna be getting eaten for breakfast.
To some extent, I think it's just a matter of the publisher finding a way to market it, right?
Yeah, if the angle. If they need an angle.
If they let the developer make it that way, you know, the way it is, and the initial impression is that this is harder than most games, then they're going to amp that up. They're going to use that to their advantage and say, this is unique. Those who want a more challenging game, you know, seek it and find it here.
Yeah. And that's fine. And that's cool. If that's their angle, they are, that means they're accepting the fact that they are going to alienate some of their audience, because there's a large chunk of audience that wants a pleasurable, not super hard experience. They want to have a fun time playing their game all the time, not just once they've gone through the boot camp. You know, it feels like this game sounds like the military. It sounds like, you know, you must go through 9 weeks of, you know, us kicking your ass until you realize that that's actually making you a better person and you're actually happier for the accomplishment after it's done. Most people don't want to go through that boot camp. It doesn't matter what the reward is on the other side. They don't want to deal with that. And that's a very real section of the video gaming public. So, you know, that's cool that they're fine with that being their angle and that being their shtick. But yeah, once again, I haven't played it, so I can't really say whether I think it's too hard or not.
What's the plot? Is there plot? Like, to what extent is it purely a mechanical exercise? Like, get through this because you should? Or is so there more?
As
I
much
think that
as,
might be why I haven't gone after it more.
As much as I appreciate the story, yeah, especially in a lot of RPGs that I look for, the plot is not really strong. It's not, it doesn't have a lot of dialogue. It's got very, very little dialogue, but there is some. I would almost compare it to Fez or something, where it's got a tiny bit of dialogue at the beginning and a tiny bit somewhere in the middle and the end. But it's really more just like this crazy immersive world that they put you in. And they give you some kind of a backstory. In this case, they give you this intro CG that's pretty long and tells you about the demons and why you're there and who you are. And what you're basically supposed to do.
In some sense, it falls into that trap that a lot of RPGs have, which is that it is not a role-playing game. Like, you have an avatar like you do in any game, but you're really not enacting any sort of role. I think
you really
RPG
are.
Got it attached is to this particular type of game where you have stats.
I don't even think about it as an RPG. I think of it as a third-person action game that's hard. Yeah.
But like, this is a sort of off
topic. Is it marketed as an RPG?
I think people refer to it as an RPG.
Action
RPG.
Okay.
Like, it's got anything that you call an action RPG is probably not. I don't know. That's a different topic for a different day.
Yeah. That's not its angle initially. I don't think that's not why people know about Dark Souls. Is because it's an enriching story plot based RPG.
It doesn't have a ton of dialogue, but it does have this emergent story. I mean, when you feel that more immersed in the world than you might in other games, and when you feel like what you're doing is accomplishing more, then it is one of those situations that how you might describe the story in Fallout or Skyrim or something like that, where you might defend the story, even if I say it's weak in Fallout, you defend it as saying, well, you know, what you did in that game exploring is kind of like your emergent story.
You're writing your own story.
You're writing your own story. And that's a lot of the case in this game. It is, but to me, it was more effective than, for example, my personal emergent story in Fallout or Skyrim. But what they do have there concretely in terms of cutscenes and dialogue or whatever at the beginning and throughout the middle sparsely and then a little at the end is... it is very cool. It's very, it's like mysterious, basically. It's a lot of mystery. I mean, that's a whole running theme in the game, too, in terms of the mechanics and even the items and what they do are not fully explained. But these systems and like the humanity or whatever, or the souls, they're not fully explained in the game. You have to figure it out as you go along, and there's some mystery that you... is explained a little bit, but a lot of it you have to read between the lines or go to the community. So it has these hardcore fans that you can go and read wikis about to get more in depth on any of that mystery that you want filled in for you.
Cool. Dark Souls. So
I'm not really sure that I can agree to nominate it since I've never played it. That feels weak.
I
feel like it needs to be tabled.
Happy to agree to nominate it, basically knowing what I know of the game. I think it's definitely... I think that the reason something should get nominated, I don't think we necessarily have to... I don't have any reason not to...
We don't have to have a consensus.
And we don't have to necessarily consensus. But I think even if we don't have... if you are just going to abstain, I am totally willing to nominate it because... The people that I know who've played it definitely think that it's something valuable, and it just has its place in the zeitgeist that it wouldn't if it weren't one of these games. I think it's a specific game with a definitive take on how gaming should be, and I think it definitely deserves...
very strong words.
Yeah.
I think
very persuasive.
I think my nomination obligates you to play it, Mike.
Well, yeah, if nothing else.
At least the first 5 hours to judge for yourself.
All right. Okay, well, I guess it passes then, because at least two of three are a resounding yes. All right.
Cool. Well, that is the escort mission, people. Thank you for listening. You have been escorted. Some housekeeping before we go. The escortmission.com is up. You should go there and read. You know, we're making various posts on it occasionally. Also, if you want to support the show, you can, at the escortmission.com, you can click through our Amazon link. Just do that. We're not going to put up a PayPal, you know, donate to the show, buy us pizza button. But this is just a way for you to help the show. If you're going to buy something on Amazon anyway, you know, one of the things we talked about earlier in the show, any of the games, just go through our Amazon link and we get a little change and you can help support the show by doing that. So,
What about social stuff?
We've got social stuff. Yes, Mike, what's our social deal?
This is just more of a warning because I wouldn't say they're fleshed out yet, but you know, we went ahead and tried to at least secure our trademark across the social media network as much as possible. So you can find us at Twitter at Escort Mission. Most likely right now it'll just be links to the podcast as they become into existence. We're also on Facebook. It's a longer URL. Just search for us and we'll put it in the it's on our site. There's a link. We're on Google Plus as well. The best thing I like about the Google Plus page, despite being basically a replica of the Facebook page, is that you can put a nice little banner image. So I cooked up a little one so that it's a little flashier graphic-wise, even though, you know, talking in Google Plus feels like,
shouting in an empty football stadium.
Yeah, pretty much. There's not a heck of a lot going on over there, it feels. But anyway, we got it just so we got it. And then the website. So, yeah, you know, go check that out. Add us. We'll be adding a lot more stuff to it as we get more people who actually say they want to get stuff there. But we at least got them.
Terrific. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Charles, for being host. Good job.
Yes, I'm cool. Charles. That was Mike.
Well done.
That was Josh. Done.
We out. Late.
Podcast over.
See you guys.